Spirit Radio Podcasts.
One of the things I was thinking about over the last couple of days is, you know, particularly as we get into 8 weeks, 9 weeks of the virus, six, just, you know, weeks of lockdown, you know, really difficult times. It's not bringing the best out of us in some ways. And some of us really are struggling. And sometimes we don't do maybe the best in terms of our reactions, locked up or cooped up in a house with a bunch of family or locked up in a house with nobody. But in the terms of family, I just thought to myself, you know, sometimes we don't present the best version of ourselves, and we lose the idea of that sometimes good enough is good enough. And sometimes we can feel really bad about how we've been towards our kids. And with that in mind, we have our parenting expert, Katrina Lynch, on the line. How are you doing there, Katrina?
Yes, I am the expert mistake maker. Mopper upper of every.
No, me first. Me first. You're getting the cue, Katrina.
Yeah.
Listen, seriously, we can regret these things. We can kind of have guilt in a way of the way we've treated our kids at times, can't we?
Yes, we can. And I, you know, sort of trawling through as I do every now and again to try to keep up to speed, various parenting websites, etc., etc., and you see a lot of things that are sort of like be careful how you speak to your child. Your child, your voice becomes their inner voice. That kind of thing, you know.
Absolutely.
And you just want to curl up and die.
I told you, if you ever had to, I have to tell you a million times. What's wrong with you? Oh, that's,
you know,
my inner voice.
You're so awkward. I can't believe you did that, you know. And then that's all you think about. And anyway, I just thought it would be a bit of fun over COVID for me personally. I'm not recommending that anybody else do this because I do not have any children at home and I have a lot of time to myself. I decided to handwrite a letter in these days of emails to one of my children, and who is now well into adulthood, and just, you know, sort of effectively say, look, I'm a human being and I've made lots of mistakes and, you know, sorry for them, etc., you know?
Yeah, very good.
And,
that's a lovely idea, Katrina.
Yeah, and he wrote back to me there, and I got the letter just yesterday or the day before. And, you know, he effectively said to me, look, your experiences have not been mine. First of all, he was very complimentary and, you know, thanked me for the letter, etc. And he said, please don't be worried about these things. Because for every maybe one thing that I did wrong, there were dozens of good things on the other side of the balance.
Yeah.
And he also said something which I came to terms with myself when I became an adult and started to break out into life. Whatever mistakes our parents have made and caused us to think in various different ways and influenced our behaviors, once we are adults, we need to take a responsibility for changing our behavior.
That's a very good point.
As St. Paul says, when I was a child, I thought as a child, I ate as a child, I drank as a child, you know, but now I am a man and I will put aside childish things. And we all know that, you know, we have these cognitive behavioral issues and we need to take responsibility for them. And there's no point in saying, well, I came from a family that was deprived or, you know, whatever. That we need to come to a point when we realize in our in intelligence and in our maturity, yes, I'm not good at that certain thing or I react badly in that certain way. And I can no longer say, because my mother had a meltdown during the COVID-19 or COVID-20, that I am now doomed for the rest of my life to behave in this particular way.
It's a fair point, actually, Katrina. And I was just thinking about even in terms of the therapy work that I do, that, you know, what you're often doing is you're trying to help people identify the things that were said to them that were possibly unkind and that may have lodged in there, and they may have said, it may have become their own voice. But the next thing very much is, now you wouldn't exactly put it in these terms, but what are you now going to do about that? You know, it's like, what, you know, where now that you know that that's what's speaking to you, how do you then replace that with, how do you become your own healthy parent, if you like, as an adult? And, you know, that's really, when people get that, that they're actually something they can say to themselves to undo some of that stuff, my goodness, they fly, you know, they really do.
Yeah, and, you know, it's part of our fallen nature, you know, that it's just part of our human weakness. But what we absolutely have to accept and realize is we are not actually responsible for the way our children fully turn out.
Absolutely. Yeah, they've absolute choices to make. And, you know, I was just thinking too, even as I was listening to you, you know, it's always handy to remember the resilience of children, you know, that idea that, you know, one negative thing in the middle of dozens of good things, you know, they kind of build it in and they go, yeah, that's you know, kind of a little bit of an eye roll. She's having a bad day today, and off we get on with it. Now, it may hurt me in the moment,
yeah.
But in the long term, there's an ability in the child to be able to go, well, it was just that once.
Yes, and the thing of it is, you know, we all grow up, it's kind of like, we grow up in a sea of constantness. Okay, let me try to clarify what I'm saying. By and large, what type of person are you for your children? That is by and large what they are going to receive and be and remember.
Absolutely.
And by and large, unless we have enormous problems, we love our children.
Of course,
and we
yeah.
want nothing but good for them. And that is really what they grow up with. And now and again we have, a slip up here and there. But that's not, by and large, what they are experiencing. And, you know, so as long as we are, you know, being reasonably sane, asking God to help us, to change us, and to make us good and kind and gentle and peaceful and all those things. That's generally speaking what our children grow up in. And the COVID that we're experiencing at the moment is a good illustration. The way we are living now is not normal.
And yeah, it's so weird, actually. Yeah.
We'll have loads of memories of it. But I doubt if we are going to be affected for the rest of our lives by these 3 months or so.
Yeah, fair point. And can I just ask you, you know, what was it like receiving that letter from your son? Was it a relief? Was it a joy? How did you receive it?
First of all, it was very... tearful. It was lovely,
I can imagine,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
And he was very complimentary about me. And I kind of only realized when I was finished reading it that in a very gentle way, he had kind of ticked me off a bit, you know. And, you know, he said at one stage, he said, I'm a big man now, you know, and I can stand up for my own mistakes. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
In other words, you know, if I decide that something has damaged me so much that I'm not going to do something about it, well, that's my problem.
Yeah.
And,
great reminder. Yeah.
And he also kind of just said to me, you know, don't be thinking about these things. And let's not, you know, sort of, I don't want you to be pondering these things anymore. That chapter is definitely closed.
Yeah, very good. I have to be honest, I had a very similar conversation with my mother towards the end, because she was forever apologising. Actually, she was forever apologising to Joanne. She never was apologising. I said, what about me? Hold on a second. I'm so sorry. I was very hard on him. She'd say to Joanne, I was like, what are you not apologising to me for? But it was like one of those moments where I turned around and I said pretty much the same as your son said to you. So it's very... you know, people do a good job, you know, and you realize that in the round, as they say, good enough is good enough. And when you communicate love, that's the most important thing, because then the person has enough in them to be able to tackle the world. And that's really what you want for them, isn't it?
Exactly. And, you know, we have to remember that our children have free choice as they become adults. And, you know, we have to learn to disassociate ourselves with our children's decisions. Especially the ones that we perceive to be negative.
Yeah,
I often say to some parents, if their child, you know, God forbid, if one of our children ended up in the cache or in prison or something other, is that my fault? You know, Or if my son does fantastically, and or my daughter, and becomes the president of the country, admired by millions.
That's still not your fault.
Is that my fault?
Yes, exactly.
Or is that thanks to me?
Yeah.
You know, and you know that we sort of have to realize, yeah, we have a particular influence of on our children for a certain period, for so long, and then after that, it's their decisions, and they're big enough to realize, am I making this decision or am I doing this because I'm allowing myself to be overly influenced or because I'm my own man or my own woman?
Very good. Very good. Katrina, great talking to you. God bless you.
We'll
talk to you next time. Bye-bye now.
God bless.
Spirit. Now, the country is bracing itself for news from the government as to whether there will be any relaxing of restrictions on the 5th of May. Meanwhile, we watch with interest to see how other countries like New Zealand and Italy get on as they take their first baby steps towards a return to some sort of normality. One thing is certain, the COVID-19 pandemic is a shock to the global economy. We just don't know how massive and how long-lasting a shock it will turn out to be. With me now to discuss the question, where is the exit for Ireland and the world from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic? We have economist Professor Ray Kinsella. You're very welcome back to the show, Ray. How are you?
Good morning, Roman. How are you?
Good, not bad. So first of all, Ray, how would you rate how Ireland is doing in combating this pandemic? A middle of the class internationally?
I think you have to say two things, Roman. The first is that it's a tough place for any government or any minister or any department to be. So it's important to acknowledge that. I think the second thing is that all governments, to a greater or lesser extent, were really caught totally by surprise. So having said that, and they're important caveats, Roman, I think if you look at the data and you look at the way things developed in Ireland, it's very clear that we could have done an awful lot better. Now, it's important to make again the point here that what we're looking at is not the performance of medical nursing and other professional staff. I mean, they have been a revelation, and it's the kind of sacrifices they have made. You couldn't repeat that often enough. But if we move from the medical and nursing staff across to the government's own performance, you got to look at the data. The number of deaths per million in Spain, Italy, France, UK, very high. Ireland's 240. Now, compare that with Germany, 76, Portugal, 90, and Hungary, 30. So there is always going to be a difference, Ronan, between different countries, different systems, different capabilities. But Ireland is not anywhere near where it could be. And you have to ask, I think, why. And I think your listeners will certainly have reflected on developments in recent months. We started from a bad place in terms of investment in healthcare, particularly ICU beds. We started from a position where we didn't have the proper equipment early enough in sufficient amounts.
Like you've been highlighting really for many years the lack of investment in the health services, and we've spoken here in this studio together about this very thing.
Yeah, I've spoken about it many times, but more importantly, so have the representative bodies, such as the IMO, such as the Irish Hospital Consultants. And you can still see it in the figures, Ronan. You can look at the number of doctors who are emigrating from the country, the number of people who are retiring. These are a build-up of a lack of investment at two levels. First of all, in capacity, particularly ICU beds and infrastructure. And the second, I would have to say that I've said many times with you and your colleagues that the relationship that the government, all governments have had with healthcare, has been based on a contractual or an adversarial relationship. There is very, very difficult to get common ground. I mean, one looks back at nurses' strikes and the abrogation of consultants' contracts. So we didn't start from a good place. There wasn't the kind of culture there that there should have been. Medical and consultant and nursing staff have responded magnificently. But, you know, you do look again at areas like the nursing home debacle, you can only say, Ronan, and you can say, we really weren't prepared. We weren't prepared at community health level. We weren't prepared in terms of monitoring and in responding. And they are areas that were foreseeable. We were slow to impose the kind of measures in terms of closing the country down because the infections primarily came initially from abroad, and we were slow. We were slow to respond, and we were slow to identify the kind of clusters that we are now tragically seeing in the nursing home sector.
Yeah, I totally agree, like, in the sense that, you know, if there's a load of people sitting around a table, and we knew very little about the virus, but one thing we did know was that it was impacting the elderly more than it was impacting the younger people. And just the simple question of, well, where do we have a load of elderly people all rammed in together? That's not a difficult question to answer, and that didn't seem to have been answered. But can I ask you a question, just broadening it out, because obviously we're under a certain amount of time pressure here. Do you think... One of the big things that people are talking about is the idea of the exit. And usually the reason that people are giving is because the economy is in trouble if we don't get back quickly. Now, I understand that, you know, an economist such as yourself, you know, there are more things than just simply the economy when we talk economics. But and if everyone's dead, there is no economy. But at the same time, do you think there's any chance of a quick exit from this lockdown?
No, and I simply don't. There are two things that are balanced, that have to be balanced here, and not just in Ireland, but globally. On the one hand, the prevention of a reoccurrence of the pandemic by relaxing too early. So doctors have a very clear view on the kind of risks embedded in that. But equally, there is a very forceful case for saying that unless a controlled exit is developed and soon, that the impact at a much wider level on health, via a number of other different routes, would also be very, very considerable. Also, Ronan, there is the issue of freedom of movement. I think probably because the government were very slow off the mark to begin with, I think there is a fairly widespread feeling that yes, you go along with the shutdown, but the kind of restrictions that there are in place, at some stage the people are going to become very dissatisfied with that kind of control over movement, necessary as it is. And at some stage, our economy, when you look at the data, Ronan, when you look at the cataclysmic fall from, say, January, when the government were projecting 3 or 4% growth and a budgetary surplus, to quite literally in an implosion in forecasts, we're looking now at maybe a contraction of upwards of 10% or more, and we're looking at unemployment rising to well over 20%.
And like, when have we seen something like that before? When have we, like, that kind of falling off a cliff thing? I know that it kind of happened around 2008, but was it as bad as that?
Worse. Nice. And at a number of levels. There was a clear epicenter in the 2008 banking and economic crisis and the collateral damage that it caused. But now we're looking not just at that epicenter, we're looking at problems that exist over global supply and demand. We're looking at, for example, the big, very big multinational companies simply changing their business model. We're looking at severe contraction of revenue coming into the government, and therefore the affordability of public services and so on and so forth. Actually, probably the biggest thing, in my view, or one of the biggest problems is after, 4 months, we still don't have a government with a democratic mandate.
I know.
Now, when you look around the world and you look at the magnitude of what's happening to the lives of people and small businesses and farmers, and you say that our politics is such that there was a complete dissatisfaction at the polls with the failure of government to deliver on housing and on healthcare and on infrastructure, and that 3-4 months on from then, we simply don't have a government. But that's a metaphor for our the ineptness of our political system and its failure to live up to its responsibilities.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and you know the fact that ultimately here we are, they may well get something together over the next couple of weeks, but there are big decisions being made in terms of people's privacy, in terms of people being told what to do. Big, what you might describe as kind of democracy issues, and without a kind of an actual proper well elected government, there could be questions later on, couldn't there?
Well. No doubt at all, because what people want most of all is a leadership that's informed by reflecting on not just where we are, but what kind of economy we should have in the future. For example, Ronan, we have an economy that's very, very dependent upon the multinational sector. Is that healthy? Because that's seriously changing. We're looking at an economy that has underinvested, not only in social infrastructure, but in farming and agribusinesses in Ireland. How is that going to be a change? We need a government that is capable of taking a long-term view on how we should adapt. Let me give you an example. A patient having suffered the kind of shock that the economy has suffered, you need a progressive adaptation, rehabilitation, rethinking life, and getting back to a better place than you were before. We don't have a government or a set of politics that has shown any competence in delivering on that. Now, until you do that, the other economic issues and the social issues that flow from that, like investment in a different kind of healthcare system, that can't happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And the economic measures, I suppose, if there is a global economic recovery, that does help us. But what is the likelihood of a sudden global economic recovery?
Well, you have to look again at the data. You look at, for example, the OECD. I mean, what the OECD have said is this is different to any previous economic crisis. If you look at the IMF and you look at Bank of England, when they draw comparisons with the Great Recession, they mean precisely that. They don't speak loosely. So the global economy, in a sense, needs to come together again. Supply chains have been broken. There is a huge dependence on an infusion of basically printing money. Now, what that passes on is an immeasurable burden of debt to our kids and our children's children. So how do you cope with that kind of debt? Because you can't continue to rely on the printing presses. The global economy needs to come back, but it needs to be a different kind of global economy. Globalization has left countries very, very vulnerable. So when I say we need a government, we need one that can reflect on how the world has changed, what has happened to us, and how the capabilities of people can be restored. For example, I'm thinking of schools and the loss of time in school for children. I'm thinking of the fact that coming out of this, it's a very regressive recession, Ronan, in the sense that the impact of it, both in terms of, for example, school work, in terms of job security, are mainly impacting on lower paid workers. So we really need a government that can get a grip on this. And I have to say, I can only speak as an economist, but when things changed before in Ireland, from the 1930s to the 1950s and 60s, to the opening of the economy, to the bad times of the 1990s, you did have governments that rose to the occasion, and had two qualities. not just people of integrity, which one has to take as a given, but people who are sensitive to issues, including faith issues. This is what economics is about in the end. It's serving the community and it's serving people. It should be an economy of service.
Okay.
We have a politics that has written God out of the equation. But when you do look at how people are hurting, particularly people, for example, who've lost, we've had over 1,000 people die. When you look at what families are feeling, the issue of faith and healing and God are hugely important.
Central,
and that's what
indeed.
Previous governments had.
Yeah. That's plenty of food for thought there. Thank you so much, economist Professor Rafe Kinsella. Thank you so much for talking to us today, and God bless you.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks.
God bless.
Bye-bye. Spirit. Now, we know that lockdown and social distancing is essential right now, but it's important we keep up communication and support for those in our community who could be feeling particularly isolated due to being visually impaired or people who are blind. And our next guest has first-hand experience of this. So on the line to tell us more, we have Kevin Kelly, Head of Advocacy at the NCBI, that's the National Council for the Blind Ireland. You're very welcome to the show, Kevin. How are you?
I'm well, Ronan. Good morning to you and your listeners.
So first of all, Kevin, can you share with us a bit about your own background and story?
Okay, so I lost my sight fully at the age of 14. Prior to that, I was short-sighted, but went about my life to a large degree. Would have played a lot of football and soccer, and you know, I was short-sighted, but it was no big deal, and would have attended regular school. But in April 2000, I had a retinal detachment in my left eye, and I had a number of operations, and they were unable to save the sight in that eye. And again, life went back pretty much to normal, minus the sport, because I was advised bangs on the head wouldn't be a good idea.
Sure.
Then in September 2001, I woke on the 18th of September, and I knew as soon as I opened my eyes that I was in trouble, because what I would describe to your listeners is the colour in my eye was running like when a tube on an old television would begin to go.
Okay.
The colours became a little bit blurry.
Yeah.
And as I knew what I was facing into, being a typical teenager, I decided I'd bury my head in the sand and ignored it, and got up, had my breakfast, got tidied up, walked down the road with my brothers and sisters to the school bus, and continued on to school, and went through three or four classes, and eventually I had to put my hand up in geography class because we were doing OS maps, which are tricky enough at the best of times to be looking at contour maps. I went to the sick bay, and then it was really a sense of deja vu. I went to the GP. The GP referred me up to the eye and ear in Adelaide Road in Dublin, seen my consultant again, multiple operations, and unfortunately they were unable to restore my sight.
And was it the same thing in both eyes, Kevin? Was it a retinal detachment in the second eye as well?
Yes, which was quite uncommon for someone who is a teenager, and it was quite a mystery for the consultant at the time as to A, why it was happening, and B, why he wasn't able to restore at least some of my sight, because retinal detachments or tears are quite common, particularly in middle-aged people, and thankfully the surgical success rate is quite high. You may not get the same level of sight back, but
you get something normally,
largely restored. And about 5 or 6 years after I'd lost my own sight, my mum began to develop some sight difficulties. And of course then they began to join the dots, and they did some research, and as it turned out, I have a thing which is quite rare called Stickler's syndrome.
Oh, okay.
Which affects connective tissue. So how I would describe it is when you would have the retina put back in place because there was a disorder of the connective tissue, it would peel off like a piece of wallpaper.
Gosh.
And alas, that answered all of the questions as to why I had retinal detachments and why surgical intervention wasn't successful.
So Kevin, was this something that would have necessarily been irrelevant for all of your tissue, connective tissue in your body, and it just showed up first in your eye because it's so much more sensitive there, or was it just specifically to the eye?
Thankfully, to date, it's only the eyes that have been affected for myself. Other people who have the condition can have problems with all their connective tissue around their joints, but thankfully, at the moment, I only have a difficulty with connective tissue in my eyes.
Wow. So for you personally, what have you noticed in terms of social distancing and lockdown? Has it impacted you in your daily life?
It has indeed impacted everyone. People who are blind and vision impaired are no different to the sighted population. We're living in unprecedented times. That's too often used phrase at the moment, and we've a number of advocacy groups around the country, and we've had regular virtual meetings. I suppose the biggest thing for people who are blind and vision impaired and don't want to basically over-egg this, but when you are blind vision impaired, you kind of depend on your sense of touch to get around and to see the world around you. And of course, at the moment, we are all very aware that hygiene is very important, and the coronavirus does live on surfaces. So a lot of people who are blind and vision impaired be somewhat robbed of that sense of touch. So
yeah, so if you're wearing gloves, for instance, that would really mess things up, wouldn't it?
Indeed it would, and it could be quite difficult for people. And then the other piece that is always difficult, and unfortunately this has been happening in some cases, we've heard reports from people who are blind and vision impaired are out and about in supermarkets or pharmacies doing what they are entitled to do. It can be a challenge to obey the 2 meters or to respect the lines that have been put in shops on the floors around distance, and members of the public, because they're feeling anxious and nervous at the moment, have been quite abusive in some cases, or have passed.
Really?
It's very
Bad, isn't it? People being abusive to somebody who's blind because they can't see that they're not 2 meters away from you, for heaven's sake. That's ridiculous.
And I think it's maybe for people maybe to think and bite their lip, because not everyone who's blind and vision impaired, it's not immediately obvious. For someone like myself, I have my cane or a guide dog, but 95% of people who are vision impaired have some residual sight, but it may not be to an adequate level to allow them to obey all of the social distancing guidelines. So in fairness, it's only a minority of the general public, but when we have opportunities like speaking on your own programme, it's just worth making people aware that people may not be able to always obey social distancing, rather than just having a blatant disregard for the rules that we're all being asked to live by.
Yeah, you know, I've heard people say before, just remember that there are all, to do the work in your own brain of the other possible things that could be going on. Like, for instance, that person who looks like they're stockpiling toilet roll might have 7 kids. You know, it's not always what you think you see. So tell us, Kevin, what supports would you personally have in place in terms of, you know, dealing with what's going on at the moment?
Yeah, I suppose for myself, I'm someone who is blind almost 19 years, so I'm quite well adjusted to my reality. But a couple of things that people who are maybe newer to sight loss or who don't have supports of friends or family are really struggling with at the moment is access to online shopping and home deliveries. And there's quite a debate raging at the moment, and the NCBI have engaged with all of the major supermarkets in the country when these new regulations came into place. And in fairness, the majority of the supermarkets, they allow people who are blind and vision impaired to shop during their dedicated hours. However, where they all failed is actually giving people who are blind and vision impaired some level of priority when placing online deliveries. And for a lot of people who are blind and vision impaired, they are the very people who were online shopping long before the majority of the general public, but now
absolutely.
They aren't able to receive orders and stuff. So
they have to wait. So can I ask you, Kevin, should there be, do you think, a little special button going, are you blind or visually impaired? Or, you know, a particular button for, you know, that would go on and that would bump you up the queue? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, so I think there's a number of ways that we can do it, and the supermarkets, like every business and organization at the moment, are facing unprecedented challenges, but I think it shouldn't be beyond the wit of man to put in place a system. Even something as simple as if you have a reference number or an order number, if you ring the local SuperValu or whatever store that you choose to do your online shopping with, they contact the local manager, and then the manager is able to bring that order forward. And if the IT departments have the time and opportunity, like when you're booking an airline flight, where you could tick a box if you require special assistance through the airport or while on board the airport, you will receive that. So I think it's very much possible to do if there's a will there.
I was just thinking, you know, you told us very beautifully about, you know, that experience that you had of becoming blind, as it were, and discovering that you were going to be blind into the future. And I'm just wondering about those people, you know, who just before the lockdown may have received a diagnosis of sight loss or deterioration of vision. Is this a time when they'll be missing social connection and support, and they don't really have the new supports in place because they haven't figured out how to live this life?
Exactly. There'll be a certain proportion of people who would have received diagnoses that are struggling. And even at the moment, there are people attending hospitals and clinics who are receiving diagnoses. I know there's much debate around what level of activity is taking place in hospitals because of the crisis. But there are people who are receiving diagnoses, and that's really challenging at the best of times, but when you add in the anxiety that has arisen in the general population due to COVID-19, it's really exacerbated. So the NCBI has launched a number of initiatives to try to ease that to some degree. So we've kind of reshaped and refigured our service delivery model, and we're doing a lot of our interventions now virtually using an array of platforms. We've also launched a national helpline, which is at 1850 33 43 53, which people can call, and we can provide them with an array of support as well as emotional support. So we are really encouraging people, if you're blind or vision impaired, if there's any of your listeners who know someone who's blind or vision impaired, to connect them in with ourselves, or even just simply pick up the phone themselves and make contact, because people with disabilities and people who are blind or vision impaired, when the world is normal and inverted common, sometimes do feel isolated, and I think the onset of COVID-19 has exacerbated that.
I absolutely agree with you. Kevin, I just want to give that national helpline out again, 1850 33 43 53. So 334353, 1850 33 43 53. That's the national helpline, and you can get all further help from there. Is that the point?
Exactly, and you can visit ncbi.ie, or we're available across all of our usual social media channels as well.
Brilliant. Kevin Kelly, Head of Advocacy at the NCBI, that's the National Council for the Blind Ireland. Thank you so much for talking to us today. God bless you.
You're welcome, Ronan.
Thanks. And as he says, www.ncbi.ie will get you to the National Council for the Blind website. Check it out.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.